This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Here's a question for you. How has your life changed during COVID? Yeah, it's a loaded question, I know. For a lot of folks in Southern California, the pandemic upended lives, including whether they wanted to stay here at all. According to the California Policy Lab, the number of Californians leaving the state went up by 12% in the days after March of 2020 and through much of 2021. Now, there are a lot of reasons to leave. Lower costs, obviously, better opportunities, the traffic. But for a lot of folks, the big motivator was to get closer to family. Well, today on Greater LA, you're going to hear from three former Angelenos about how leaving LA helped each of them reconnect. KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo has the story.
Philadelphia was the last place Lexie Bartolo thought she'd end up at. Born and half-raised outside of Atlantic City, she vividly remembers listening to stories about the area. Some great, but others?
For the entirety of my life growing up, this whole region was like my mom's great horror story. In some like charming ways, like she met like my father here, but also just in the, because she's from Whittier, so she's like, you couldn't get a tortilla. You got them in cans.
You heard that right. Canned tortillas. It used to be a thing. Courtesy of Old El Paso. You know those guys, the ones who make jarred salsa and taco kits. Anyway, growing up, Lexi and her mom moved around a lot, and she ended up going to high school and college in SoCal. And in early 2020, just before the novel coronavirus changed everything, Lexi and her husband moved to London so she could pursue a master's degree. But when classes went virtual, the two were faced with a decision.
For me and my spouse, it opened up this really interesting window into what kind of life do we want to lead, like in a practical level. We both love Los Angeles. We met doing improv, like very classic 2012 love story. We also like kind of had to own up to the fact and like be very realistic about finances. And we sort of knew that LA was probably not a place that we would ever like ethically own property if we were ever to even be able to own property.
So they started looking around. Boston was too cold, New York too expensive, but there was always Philly, her mom's worst nightmare, but maybe a viable option.
And it's funny when I say this to people here, I'm like, Philadelphia was kind of like a compromise decision. Everyone's like, oh yeah, I get that. Because the first question is quite often, why did you move here? There's like this really stubborn belief amongst like, especially people who are like born and raised here, like, yeah, this town's great, but like no one else knows that. So how did you figure it out?
Since they couldn't actually visit Philly because, hello, COVID, Lexi opted for the next best thing, house hunting on Zoom. They found a real estate agent on Instagram of all places and placed their trust in buying a home in a virtual stranger online.
There are things that you won't possibly know, especially about like the character of neighborhoods in Philadelphia until you get here. Our realtor was like almost 6 feet tall. So we had the Lindsay test. Like if she couldn't stand up comfortably somewhere, we were like, no, this is not possible.
The brick two-bedroom, one-bathroom house they found is nowhere close to what they could have gotten in LA. They've even got a stoop because, you know, East Coasters and their stoop culture, and a garden that's helped Lexi get to know her master gardener of a neighbor better. It's been a year since Lexi settled into her South Philly neighborhood, and as much as she loves it, she says yes, she does still miss things about LA.
There's a certain rhythm to, like, talking to someone in LA that feels very, like, comfortable and very familiar. In terms of the city, that's a tougher question.
You mean to say you don't miss the traffic, astronomical rent prices, or smoggy air? I digress. Would she ever come back, though? Well, the jury's still out on that one.
I don't know. We are now in a different place that has its own set of characters and its own set of stories, and it's delightful in its own way. It's not home yet.
It's that same idea of home and reconnecting with your roots that pushed another Angeleno into leaving not just LA, but the entire U.S. last year. Born in Mexico City, Ana Sheila Victorino moved to the States as a young girl, and throughout her childhood, had to balance what it meant to be an American and how to honor her Mexican roots. In 2019, her dad died, setting off a chain of events that ultimately led to her move back to her ancestral home of Coyoacán, a leafy Mexico City borough full of colonial architecture and art.
For me, moving to Mexico and having this experience was a way for me to connect with my dad.
The pandemic made it possible.
all the reasons that were getting in the way of me making this happen were slowly getting lifted and the call was getting louder. So when the pandemic started, the things that I was doing that were in physical locations, you know, we realized actually they don't need to be in physical locations. We can do this work remotely. So I was like, oh my God, everything's lining up for me to finally make this happen.
And in most ways, Ana Sheila says life in Guayacan isn't much different than the U.S., but it's afforded the opportunity to find parts of herself that she was always searching for. Going home even helped her strengthen her own ability to speak her mother tongue.
Spanish is my love language. Spanish is the language that I learned to love in, and that holds a really special place in my heart. It's like I felt like I wasn't fully able to express myself in the language that feels closest to my, like, you know, soul, I guess.
And yet, Ana Sheila says she misses L.A. It's the place she's lived the longest, but she doesn't see herself coming back anytime soon.
If I could find a way to live in both places, I would love that. But I mean, I'm still very much enjoying this journey out here.
If Ana Sheila was able to reconnect with their roots by leaving L.A., for another Angelino, a move was a chance to provide some family roots for the next generation. During much of 2020, Cosette Livingston was living in a cute two-bedroom house in Southgate and worked a full-time job based out of downtown L.A. When time permitted, she'd hang out with her four-year-old grandson, Colt. Those early days of COVID were good to Cosette, albeit anxiety-inducing, and she was getting paid to stay home and spend time with family.
I was happy taking care of my grandson and kind of got a little hobby of coloring and coloring books with him. And I was enjoying it, which is kind of goofy for an adult, but I just was totally happy.
And then her landlord unexpectedly died in late March of 2020. At that moment, she knew her life was about to change.
I was glad to leave, but I didn't know where to go. And I talked to my son, who owned this house up here in Crestline.
Crestline is a small town just west of Lake Arrowhead in the San Bernardino Mountains. And Cosette's son suggested she move in with him and work remotely. She found herself surrounded by trees, nature, and having to go get your mail from the post office because, you know, hashtag mountain life.
The highlight of my day is going to check my mail, and then I'll stop at the grocery store for anything I need. And the nice thing is the grocery store is literally across the street from the lake. And when the sun shines on the water, it just gets all sparkly and pretty, and everything is so fresh up here. I don't have to worry about traffic where I live. I can take my grandson for a walk and not worry about him getting kidnapped or anything like that. And I mean, I still don't let him play outside by himself because there are bears here. The bears know when trash day is. It's Thursday for us. And if we put our trash cans out on Wednesday night, they're all dumped over and gone through by the bears.
In spite of the sparkling lake and adventures with bears, Cosette says her relocation isn't permanent. She's already planning her move back down the hill and into the city. Why? Well, for the big return a lot of us are faced with right now, heading back into the office. She's already back in her downtown LA job twice a week, commuting by both car and train.
Ends up being about 2 to 2.5 hours to commute each way. And I don't mind doing it 2 days a week, but I'm not going to be able to do it 5 days a week. That's for sure. It's just exhausting.
Despite the whirlwind of moving 80 miles northeast in the middle of a pandemic, Cosette is grateful for this surreal moment in history. It reminded her that no matter the situation, she will always support her family when they're in need. That the COVID of it all might have been a scary road, but it's one she can profoundly appreciate. For KCRW, I'm Danielle Chiriguayo.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. Lauren Miller was one of the nation's most prominent civil rights lawyers. You might have seen his name while driving around LA. There's a park and a school named after him in South Los Angeles. And now his home in Silver Lake has been tapped to become a historic city landmark. Even so, there are a lot of folks who don't know about his life and his work fighting discrimination. Dr. Amina Hassan wrote a book about Miller titled Lauren Miller, Civil Rights Attorney and Journalist, and she's with us right now. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Hassan.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What was it about Lauren Miller that made you want to spend so much time learning and writing about him?
Well, I only knew his name as, you know, growing up from Los Angeles, but I didn't know more than that. And years later, I asked my father, and my father at the time when I was growing up, before he became an engineer, was a mail carrier. And he said he went into the Kansas City Statehouse in Los Angeles with two white guys who were also carriers, letter carriers, and they refused to serve my father. So he hightailed it to Lauren Miller because he was so well known. And also my mother knew his wife, Juanita Miller, but I just knew his name. And then later on, when I was looking for a project, I went out to the Huntington Library and they had just received the latest documents, 16 dusty boxes that have been in the basement of his son for years.
Where did he grow up and what brought him to L.A.?
Well, he was born in 1903 in Pender, Nebraska, during the American coal famine, and he's the son of a former slave who married a white woman, which was quite unusual at the time. And they're extremely poor, but they knew he was extremely intelligent and smart. Even the judge in the town would invite him to sit in the courthouse to watch the proceedings. So he was well respected. The family was well respected. They were, I think, the only black family in Pender, Nebraska at the time. He graduated in 1928 from Washburn College in Kansas with a degree in law. Although he trained as a lawyer, what he really wanted to do was to become a writer, to write novels and poems. But he said he was dragged kicking and screaming into the practice of law because he said, you know, in those days, a Negro could be a doctor, lawyer, or school teacher, and that's about all. He came to Los Angeles in 1929, and he first worked as a journalist. But the need to put food on the table at the height of the Great Depression propelled him to work as both a journalist and a lawyer. And by that time, he was married. Thurgood Marshall called him the best civil rights attorney on the West Coast.
Tell us a little bit about the time that he was a journalist.
He co-founded the Los Angeles Sentinel, which is still in business. And 1934, I think that was. And later in 1951, he bought the California Eagle, one of the longest running African-American newspapers in the West. He was writing about the black community in Los Angeles. And for the Los Angeles Sentinel, he was their attorney and he wrote most of the editorials. He didn't really have a byline in those days. But in 1951, it was quite apparent that he wrote a great deal of what was in the newspaper.
He became, as you mentioned, we talk about his work as an attorney, and Thurgood Marshall saying that he was one of the best. Is there a particularly important case that he worked on that stands out to you?
Yeah, alongside Thurgood Marshall, Lauren Miller argued two landmark civil rights cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, the first one in 1948, whose decisions effectively abolished racial restrictive housing covenants. The Shelley v. Kramer case, that's the really famous one, is taught in every law school in the country. He's also credited with writing the majority of the law briefs in Brown v. Board of Education that ended segregation in the public schools. During the war, he, along with the Southern California ACLU, challenged the internment of the Japanese Americans. And even the national office of ACLU wouldn't challenge that, but the Southern California one, and I believe a Northern California one did. But Miller was a part of that. And because he lived in Silver Lake, he had Japanese neighbors. And when they went off to war, he held their deeds until they returned.
Well, thank you for coming on and talking about his life. I know there's still a lot of interest in his home in Silver Lake and the push, of course, to make it an historical place. Dr. Amina Hassan, author of the book Lauren Miller, civil rights attorney and journalist. Thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate it being asked.
This is Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you've heard these chords in a movie score, then you know the work of a musical heavyweight. That's one of the main themes from Brokeback Mountain, composed by Gustavo Santaolalla. He's been a musical fixture in L.A., behind the scenes with all kinds of tastes, and for the last couple of decades featured as part of the big screen. A native of Argentina, he worked his way through the rigors of the instruments of film and music to a success that few musicians really have. Let's just say he's seen and been through a lot in his 70 years, and he's performing a concert at UCLA's Royce Hall tomorrow to highlight almost all of it. Gustavo Santaolalla, multi-instrumentalist, songwriter, producer, composer. Welcome to you, sir. Do we have him on the line? Gustavo?
This is Gustavo. Who's this? Steve?
This is Steve Chiotakis. How are you, sir?
Hey, Steve, how are you doing? Very good, sir, here in the middle of rehearsals. Yeah.
You sure are. Wow, you're getting ready for some music, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is such a special event for me, you know, such a special concert.
But we are happy to have you with us. I want to talk about your beginnings. You know, when you were a musician in Argentina, you played a unique style that combined rock, you know, which is an American form with Latin folk music. I mean, it's called rock nacional. How did that fusion of sound come about?
I come, you know, from the 60s, from that era. So in that time, I believed rock stopped being, you know, rock and roll and just like a rhythm. But it became actually almost like the folk music of the young people in the world. And you could see in the same stage Jimi Hendrix and Donovan, you know, one the super electric and the other one with an acoustic guitar. And it was all rock. I mean, it was all in this was the music that actually the young people of the world choose to use as a language to express their views and their insatisfaction, you know, with the establishment. And I think it became really a world thing. And I thought, well, you know, I don't want to do a band that is just a cover band of a band from America and from England, which I loved, you know. I want to do something that will bring something to this world folk music that is rock. And I was criticized by the rock intelligentsia in Argentina, because they would say, that's not rock. I mean, you know, you're playing a rhythm of chacarera with an electric guitar. What is that? Or you're using a charango, no? Or a ronroco. I mean, what is that? But thank you. You know, my dad used to say time equalizes everything, no? And I think time somehow, you know, proved that we were right, you know, doing that's the way, you know. At that time, you know, I don't think even the word world music was was coined, you know.
When did you move to Los Angeles?
I moved to Los Angeles in those dark years where in my country disappeared 30,000 people at the hands of the government. So
this was the dirty war.
I was many times in jail between 15 and 24, 25 years when I came here, just for having long hair and playing rock music. You know, I didn't belong to any political party. I wasn't a delinquent. I didn't do anything. But, you know, they will stop you for a day, 2 days, supposedly checking your records. But basically, you know, I mean, there were people that they cut their hair or they got beaten up. I was lucky enough not to have that. And actually, by the time I was 20, I was pretty popular, so they knew who I was, but they still made my life miserable. So I had nightmares with the police even 2 years after moving to the States. But I moved here in 1978, in the peak of the military junta in Argentina.
What was it like? What was the music scene like in L.A.? Late 70s. I'm thinking Sunset Strip. I'm thinking so much going on, right?
Yeah, I was very disappointed when I arrived here because the bands that were actually... Rock had become very corporate, and the bands that were really happening, which were bands like Styx and Boston and Kansas, they were bands that I really didn't like, you know? Nothing against them, you know, Journey, I mean, but and for me, they didn't represent what, you know, that music, you know, rock, the music that we were talking about. You know, I was coming from a country that they were putting me in jail for for having, you know, long hair and playing electric guitar, and suddenly this was like, you know, limousines and corporate rock. But that year, 78, was also the year that the Sex Pistols disbanded in San Francisco. But, you know, it was the year where the Pistols, the Ramones, then suddenly the Clash, all this was happening. And that was like really something that gave me hope. And I, you know, I cut my hair, I got my skinny tie, and I became a punk new waver. And I had a band called Wet Picnic that... we played here around town and on the club scene, and we got to play with bands like X and the Blasters and the Go-Go's. I mean, we were part of that scene, you know, the Screamers, that LA scene that was at the time was really boiling, you know, it was fantastic.
I wanna love, but I was not that strong, so I should keep my senses soon. I need defenses.
You eventually found yourself, Gustavo, in film scoring, and you worked with the Mexican director Alejandro González Iñárritu. How did you make that transition from punk, you know, skinny tie and wet picnic to, you know, doing these major motion pictures?
Yeah, I had actually, you know, always been very interested in all sorts of music, and I was always also interested in film. I actually wanted to study film when I finished high school. I was already making records, but the military government of the time in Argentina closed the Institute of Cinematography, and we didn't have a school where to study. But I always been very interested in film, and actually many people always have people will tell me, you know, your music is very visual. You know, your productions are always so visual. And it's true. I mean, I conceive music in visual terms. So in a way, it was a natural and organic transition.
You won the Oscar for Brokeback Mountain. And then the year later, this happened.
And the Oscar goes to Gustavo Santaolalla for Babo.
Gustavo Santaolalla said that his hope for the score of Babel was for it to not sound like the music of a National Geographic documentary.
Now that, Gustavo, cracks me up. Because did you tell the Oscar people that if I do win, I want you to say this?
No, I don't know why they say that. I don't know. But I have said it in interviews. I knew that I wanted to sound it like world music, but I didn't want it to sound like it belonged to any particular place. I didn't want it to sound like a National Geographic magazine documentary. We go to Morocco and we hear Moroccan music. We go to the border with Mexico and the United States and we hear border music. You know, we go to Japan and we hear. I wanted to have a vibe, a feel of world music, but that you can actually more be like planet music, you know?
You have a concert tomorrow night at Royce Hall on the UCLA campus, and you'll be playing music.
That's true.
Yeah, you'll be playing music from your career with your current band, Santa Banda, right? And
yes,
some folks
yes.
may even know, you know, they may know you more for your film work, for Babel, for Brokeback Mountain, and the other things
Correct.
That you've done in Hollywood. What can you expect when you see the show tomorrow?
For different reasons, right before the pandemic, you know, I decided to press pause, something that I've named the button of pause, and look back at my life and see how did I get here, you know. I put together this show that is called Desandando el Camino, loosely translate as unwinding the road. And it's basically a journey through my life, the story of my life through my music. So I'm playing things that I wrote when I was very young, 15, 16 years old, until now. So I go through songs, my songs, songs from movies, music from movies, music from video games, etc. So, you know, you can expect a very eclectic show with some unbelievable musicians, because the band really is something else.
Gustavo Santaolalla, multi-instrumentalist and songwriter, producer, composer. Your life on stage tomorrow, and I can't wait to hear all about it and to hear you in the future. Gustavo, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I hope you can make it to the show.
Well, that's all the time we have for this evening. Hoping you'll hit us up tomorrow when we talk about the new 6th Street Bridge. It's almost done in DTLA. We're at kcrw.com/greaterLA. How are you doing? What stories would you like to hear? You can grab the podcast, too, at the website kcrw.com/GLA. Jenna Cagle, Nihar Patel, Andrea Bautista, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Tom, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all put hard work into tonight's episode. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and time this evening. Have a great night.